This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The opening of the Beckler Museum of Art provides Charlotte with both a unique space to exhibit modern art and a fine collection, our experience of which begins even before you enter the building. The amazing Firebird sculpture stands outside the Beckler on South Tryon Street, welcoming visitors and bringing a sense of whimsy and excitement to everybody who passes by. Firebird is the work of French-born artist Nikki de Saint-Fall, and the Beckler Museum is now showcasing 55 more of her works in an exhibition called Nikki de Saint-Fall, Creation of a New Mythology. The exhibition is contained inside the museum, but also spills out onto the green across South Tryon with large format sculptures which visitors, including children, are encouraged to touch. Saint-Fall was one of the most significant and unconventional female artists of the 20th century, and we're going to find out more about her and about her work this hour. We are joined by the artist's daughter, Laura Duke. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Get a little closer to that microphone. The microphone is your friend on this program. Her granddaughter, Bloom Cardenas, is also with us in our Spirit Square studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
John Boyer is president of the Beckler Museum of Art. He returns. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mike.
And we welcome Dave Stevenson, trustee of the Nikki de Saint-Fall Charitable Art Foundation.
That's correct.
And the three of you, and this includes a fifth person I haven't introduced yet, are the trust.
Yes.
Okay. And the fifth person who will be joining us periodically here is Marcella Zitali, who for 17 years assisted the artist in her work. And I'm sure you have some stories to share with us, and we'll have you do that. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
I'm intrigued that both the Nikki de Saint-Fall Charitable Art Foundation and the Beckler is encouraging people to touch these giant sculptures, even children. These are still one-of-a-kind works of art. Are you mad?
no mad than we're normally mad, I guess, Mike. There is a distinction to be made, and I'm glad that you brought this up. The five pieces across the street, in the same way that we encourage this with the Firebird, are meant to be embraced both literally and figuratively. And in fact, three of the pieces, are designed in such a fashion that you can get inside or on top of them to sit down. And this, of course, is quite different from the 55 pieces you see in the museum setting itself. So it's rare to have a single exhibition provide this much opportunity for engagement by what we know is going to be a very wide audience to enjoy Nikki's work.
And I'm told that you, Bloom, lived in one of your mother's big-scale sculptures for a while?
Well, she created a sculpture park.
Your grandmother, excuse me.
My grandmother. Yes. She created a sculpture park in Italy called the Taro Garden, and she lived inside the sculpture, the Sphinx, the Empress.
She lived inside.
She lived in it. And so I would come for holidays and live in there with her. She had the room in the right breast and the kitchen in the left. And so it was a very unique experience.
I would say. Now, Nikki de Saint-Fall was your mother, Laura.
Yes.
She was born in France in 1932, a relatively well-off family, and then the Great Depression hit, and they lost their banking fortune, and at some point moved to New York City when she was seven.
Three.
Yeah. She must have always had an unconventional streak, because what I read about her, she was expelled quickly from convent school. When did she first start exhibiting this artistic bent?
When I was a baby. Mm-hmm. So she started working, painting when I think I was about two, so it was in the early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
But she made her career, she started her public career really with a bang in 1960.
But, if she was born in 1930, and there's, 30 years in between there, she was rebellious through her life.
Yes.
In school, she was in and out of schools, changed schools a lot, did things like, I think she, at the age of 14, she painted all the fig leaves on one of the school's statues bright red, and she was told either to leave the school or get psychiatric help.
I think she was very aware of the hypocrisy and the double talk.
At 14?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, because of misbehavior in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And she just, it was too much for her to bear, and she had to, express herself and one way or another
mm-hmm.
to, bring some truth out. So I think that's what led her, and she continued.
Of course, she was your grandmother, so Bloom, you knew her later in her life. Had she settled down any, or is she still this free spirit, wild spirit, rebellious spirit?
Totally free, wild, and I considered her a magician in the sense that nothing was impossible. If she set her mind to something, a few years later, you would see it physically in front of you. So I knew she could do anything, and that meant as far as her imagination would take her. Mm-hmm. So...
Put her in context in terms of her artistic output. There are 55 works on display here.
Yes.
But that's only a small portion of what it continues to exist and what she created throughout her life. How prolific was she?
Well, exceptionally. In fact, in addition to doing an extraordinary number of individual works, she was one of the artists who experimented by working in series of pieces. She would revisit a subject over and over and over again. As she changed first as an individual, as an intellectual, and as an artist, and so you see in a certain theme a considerable evolution and a variety of interpretations on Nikki's part. And so that's one of many reasons why you have this extraordinary body of work. And in the show that we've assembled with the help of the foundation, we've attempted to follow Nikki from 1964, when she really begins this first burst of maturity as an artist, right up through her death in 2002. And the principal theme is her voracious appetite for myth and legend and cultural archetype from around the globe and over the millennia, because she was a true intellectual and in many ways self-taught, you know, with all of the perils and the advantages of being an autodidact, deeply and widely read, with an extraordinary group of friends who were artists and writers and, in fact, all kinds of people. And what you can't help but come up with is a remarkable body of work. And I think that's what you certainly see in this show, is great variety, great depth, but ultimately great joy. I mean, this is an unusually engaging show, I think, for an audience like our region's. And they are, to be sure, not that familiar with her work in person unless they've had the chance to travel, except for the Firebird. And while there are aspects of the exhibition that are similar to the Firebird, there's a great deal more in this exhibition, too.
As you well know, John, there are people out there who don't get contemporary art, modern art, pop art. They just don't get it. And they think, in the back of their mind, well, I could do that. Because it's not realistic in some cases. In this case, it's whimsical. It's all over the place.
Yeah.
That is not true.
You know, it isn't true. I mean, you're right. First of all, what is true that there are many people who don't get it, which, by the way, I love.
Really? Why?
Well, both personally and institutionally, that's exactly the kind of challenge we feel is important to face and to embrace. You know, there are a lot of things in life you feel like you just don't get until suddenly you get it. And this is all about growth. I mean, it's growth as an individual, personally, emotionally, psychologically. I mean, this happens all the time in our lives, and we shouldn't segregate something like the arts as somehow ungettable because I didn't do X. I didn't go to college. I didn't go to graduate school. I didn't know any artists.
I never took an art class.
Never took an art class. Doesn't matter.
Can't draw a straight line.
Doesn't matter. I'm telling
neither
you what.
Neither did she.
Yeah. Right. Which she
really?
Both lamented and celebrated. And you should expand on that because she, being self-taught is one of the key aspects of who she was as an artist.
Yeah, well, when she found her way, another artist recommended that she didn't go to art school because that would break her, and that she had total freedom not having been taught all those concepts and ideas and how to draw perspective. And she would say she could, her husband would try and teach her perspective and it would work for maybe 3 days and then she just couldn't do it. And I think one of the aspect of Nikki that is interesting in what you were just saying, John, is that she's engaging all kinds of audiences. Mm-hmm. And so if you know a lot about art history, you can read her art on a certain level. And if you don't know anything and you're a child, you can climb on it, you can experience different materials, different colors, and realize that, again, you can do anything if you want to.
But then what makes it art? This is what people have trouble with. They can look at a Rembrandt and know that they can't do that. I could not paint that picture. But they look at some modern art. They look at the Firebird, for instance. And you may, I must tell you, for the longest time until I learned the name of the piece, I thought that the Firebird had big legs. But he doesn't. That's an arch. that the Firebird is sitting on. Now, I know I couldn't do that piece, but if a person is an artist and can't do perspective, can't draw a straight line, and does what they do, obviously that comes from their inner core, which gives them the spirit and the mind and the eye of an artist. But what makes it art? How can I determine that that's art and that's good art?
Let me give you one comparison that might be helpful for any listening audience. There are so many great musicians who move us and produce some of the most memorable pieces we will ever hear in our lives who cannot read a note of music. You know, we have to be careful as we consider the distinctions between technical proficiency as grounded in centuries-old notions of linear perspective, you know, I can't draw a sense of depth, and an artist's ability to communicate deep, personal, and somehow universal emotions and to create responses, not with everybody, but with most everybody, that are genuine and real and moving. I mean, and so I think that we look at art from a number of perspectives, but I think the core human, you know, profoundly emotional, engaging is the most important, because there are, in fact, people who can absolutely duplicate to the smallest iota a Rembrandt painting, and it's a fake, and is it art? So is it technical proficiency, or is it something else? And it's the something else that makes great art. That's the difference.
Dave Stevenson, you're a trustee with the Nikki Charitable Art Foundation. Obviously, you must like her work because you're a part of the foundation. So what attracted you to that work in the first place?
Well, I met Nikki through another client, and I really didn't know anything about art. I'm a business manager and a CPA, and so my role in her life was to be her business manager. It was over the years that I came to appreciate what an important artist she was, and I just knew her as a person and a fun person at that.
Then you're a right brain, a left brain thinker, right? I mean, if you're a CPA,
I don't know, left brain, right?
I can never.
Brain worked completely differently than hers did.
We'll come back to that, Laura.
Since you're bringing the question of brains, she was friends with a number of scientists and Nobel winners, and you know, and they had her do some tests. And it turns out that the people who can do perspective are not very good at 3D. It's a brain wiring that is distinct for sculptures. So she has the wiring of a sculpture, not so much of a painter. So they had tests, and, you know, she couldn't do perspective, and she was very surprised by some of the outcomes, but she could do other things that others can't do. So it just, we were talking about brains, so I'm just bringing it up.
Well, I'm glad. But you were saying, Dave, that you're, you know, you're a CPA, you're a business guy, and you found her to be fun and delightful, et cetera. Is it because, I guess maybe opposites attract, because she could be what you could not be, because you're kind of a straight-laced Tweety guy?
Well, I don't know how to take that, Mike.
It's a compliment.
Great. No, she was just a really interesting person to know. I mean, the way that I met her was through, as I say, a mutual client who was a Nobel laureate scientist at the Salk Institute. And my life was full of people like that, but I had never had an artist.
By the way, we're talking about the artist Nikki de Saint-Phalle, whose work is being featured prominently at the Bechtler. You can go onto our website at WFAE.org and see some of the pieces that we'll be talking about through the program. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Garage Door Guru, a fourth-generation garage door technician offering local comprehensive garage door service for over 11 years, including repairs and door installations. Details and appointments, 704-661-9070. The Discovery of America by Christopher Columbus, The Origins of Thanksgiving, and the Relationship of the Pilgrims with the Native Americans, The Civil War. These are all things that you learned about in school as a child, but what you learned, what you think you know, may not be true. Textbooks often include errors, some of them major, and we're going to take a look at textbook accuracy in history, social studies, even science, and find out what they often get wrong and what's being done to correct it Monday morning at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, Congress agrees to fund the government for another 3 weeks. The EPA proposes new emission standards for U.S. power plants. And Fed Chair Bernanke says the recent surge in oil prices will not damage the American economy.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning at 10 on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking about the artist Nikki de Saint-Phalle. You know her work because she's the person responsible for Firebird, the big sparkly sculpture outside the wonderful Beckler Museum of Art downtown on South Tryon Street. They're opening an exhibit called Nikki de Saint-Phalle, Creation of a New Mythology, March 18th, which was today. It's today. It opens today. And runs through October the 3rd at the Beckler Museum. And much of it spills out onto the green, these large, oversized, very big sculptures. And before the break, we were talking about art and what constitutes art. And Laura Duke, who is Nikki de Saint-Phalle's daughter, who is with us, wanted to follow up on
yes,
that.
Yes, because you mentioned Rembrandt. So mm-hmm. that was like 5 centuries ago. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the world has changed so much. And I think the function of the artist is like to connect the people to the changes in a profound way. So sometimes there's rejection, but I think that Nikki, who was very provocative in the beginning, has really found a language that is accessible to everybody. And so I just wanted to say that.
Okay. Let's go back to the beginnings. I mean, you're her daughter. You were around for the beginnings of her art career. And as John Boyer, who is the president and CEO of Beckler Museum, said a moment ago, she's largely self-taught, although certainly had influences and guidance and mentors along the way. Mm-hmm. But when she started, she had no official training. I guess the question would be, at what point did her work begin to attract attention? And at what point did people realize this woman has some sort of special talent here?
Well, I think she became, when she came, as I said before, she came in the public scene with a bang because she did shooting paintings.
Yes, I want to talk about that.
Yeah. So really she, you know, that was a big, that was her entry. But, Bloom, I think you should pick up from here.
I think one thing that's very important to say as far as Nikki, because she didn't go to art school, but unlike most people go to art school and learn about all the artists and everything, she, with her husband and my mother, went to all the museum, the churches, the chapels all over Europe. So she actually had a more personal education in art history than most of us who did go to art school and only saw them in books. So that's already her relationship to art was more profound, I would say, than a lot of scholars who just experience through books.
Bloom Cardenas is Nikki de Saint-Phalle's granddaughter, and we also have with us Marcello Zitali, who assisted the artist for 17 years. And we've talked around the edges of these sculptures. And we mentioned a few seconds ago that she thought in three dimensions and so was more of a sculptor than a painter. But the sculptures that she produced are not Michelangelo's David. They're whimsical, out there pieces. Did you always know, because you assisted her in this, did she always know at the outset that these sculptures could be achieved? Because you're defying some of the laws of gravity here in some cases. Did she always know that it would work?
Yeah, but she used to try several different things. And that's very important because she was probably one of the artists. She wasn't afraid to change. And always she was trying to do different things, defying the gravity and everything. You know, she wanted to have different experience about mm-hmm. it. And related to whatever we were saying, John had a phrase, I think a very nice one, technique is nothing. The dream is everything. And she was one of the most passionate person I ever met. And she was workaholic. She needed to express herself mm-hmm. all the time. And she was all the time working. She didn't ask so many questions about that. She was a passionate. You know, that's the most important thing about Nikki.
And manic.
And manic.
And to come back to the shooting paintings,
okay.
I think she also, she was a feminist, and she wanted, you know, the woman's expression to be manifested. So, she had a lot of issues as far as woman being able to be on the scene and be heard and be seen.
I think the idea is the most important thing in the modern art. I think in the religion part of Nikki's work, I think it's very important because she was a very spiritual person, but she was shooting to the church. So it was her way to find the real inside spirituality for herself and everybody else.
Back up. She was shooting through the church. What does that mean?
Yeah, because some of the shooting painting has a church image.
Images.
And
okay.
It was very provocative by the time in the 60s.
Let's back up here. We're talking about the shooting paintings. Let's explain the process of these shooting paintings. Go ahead. I'm not going to get involved in this. You explain it. Who wants to take a crack at that?
John. I'll take a crack, and then I'm sure they'll fill in. it's interesting. Notoriety as an artist is very much an asset because it can attract the attention of your colleagues and potential collaborators.
Okay.
and certainly the critical art world. But this is clearly not why Nikki was doing this. To Laura's point, Nikki was looking at the very beginning of her career, sort of the most forceful means of expression she could determine to reveal her angst and, frankly, her anger about a lot of personal issues from her youth, about institutional issues, about religion and education, and certainly about politics. And so she elected to construct canvases inside of which were bags of paint, and they would be mounted at the opposite end of a gallery, and she would pick up a rifle and shoot them. Now, she had
Shoot
the canvases, yeah. And so
they would bleed.
And they would bleed the paint. Okay. Now, sometimes these canvases were actually larger constructions in the shapes of cathedrals, which is now to Marcello's point. And so there, it was a much clearer assault on organized religion and its many failures as she understood it.
Would she do this in a public setting, or would these people see these after the fact of being shot?
Well, it was both.
And watch them do it.
That's right.
Yeah.
And this is a performance aspect. Now remember, this is the rise of performance art in the late 50s and 1960s reaching its apogee. Well, I don't know that it's ever reached its apogee. And so she was in there at the very beginning. And I think that's important. Her being self-taught and her having the good fortune to be in the company of some of the most remarkable artists of this period, in addition to Jean Tinguely, who would become her husband, but Robert Rauschenberg was a good friend, and Larry Rivers, and Eve Klein, and I mean, these are major
Jasper
figures.
Johns, de Kooning.
It's a remarkable
Jackson
catalog.
Pollock.
And so all of these kind of mutually reinforcing experiments were critical to how they became the artists they did, and one of them for her were these shooting paintings.
Now Jackson Pollock, correct me if I'm wrong, he's the guy that just threw paint on canvas, is that right?
Well, one could put it that way.
Well, that was one of his
yeah,
techniques.
That's right, and dripped. You know, very often the canvases were on the ground.
So
and
how does this
them.
Differ from the shooting paintings? What I mean, there's a little more violence, I suppose. Percussive violence.
He was very much influenced by Pollock. He had his first exhibition in Paris, and you can see right away when Nikki is before the shootings, you can see how she's adapting and taking, which is what artists do, from others, what is actually going on. And she already digested it and transformed it into something personal. And then eventually, a little bit after that, the shooting paintings come. She really built out construction. There were toys in it. There were all kinds of objects. So it was like a sculptural relief. And then sometimes she invited others to shoot, and then it would bleed different colors. And so there's the element of chance and accident, which is the whole John Cage. She really is in the line of many artists.
These shooting paintings and probably some of the other things that she did have led to this her being called unconventional. I'm sure that she didn't set out to be unconventional. Did she think of herself as being unconventional or just creative?
Yeah, creative, because as I said, you know, the art is related to the times. This was the Cold War. This, we, you know, there was thought of complete annihilation of the planet. Mm-hmm. I mean, these were violent times. So, you know, as an artist, that's what you're supposed to do, you know, to reflect the times. You know, I mean, before, the painters who did court paintings, now they were, you know, she was reflecting the reality of the time in her own way.
This is where
and that's why people picked up on it, because suddenly there was a resonance.
And this is where some people have trouble with contemporary art, because they think art should be pretty and be something to hang behind the sofa on the wall. And what a lot of contemporary artists spend their time doing is commenting on the times. The art has a message in it.
Well, you know, I think any true art does have a message in it, and sometimes it's a pretty message, which is fine too. Mm-hmm. But you're right. For those who imagine that art is contained by a desire for it to be pretty and pleasing and soothing, although there is very much a place for that, let's not kid ourselves, but it has to be so much more than that. You can never appreciate the art that is soothing and beautiful and pretty if it's not understood in the context of those works that are more challenging. And by the way, we apply this to everything. We apply it to film and to literature and to even certain forms of music and other creative arts. If the entire literary world were made up of books that were just pleasing, we would all go crazy.
Yeah.
If every film were just another, you know, Bob Hope Road show, although, by the way, I love the Road movies with Bing Crosby, but if that was the total extent of American filmmaking, yeah, we'd all go crazy.
And so that's why there's a place for Frank Sinatra and Guns N' Roses.
Well, I hope so.
Okay.
That's right. All those great duet albums. So, but I do think,
and
I think that happens too, Mike, because we need it to happen. You know, we turn to art for all kinds of reasons, not only to find redemption, although we do, but we also look to it for provocation and excitement, and we need all of those things.
For understanding also, like, as you grow as a human being at different stages, different art speaks to you differently. And so maybe when you're young, you're going to love more classical Degas. Mm-hmm. And then as you get older, you look at Degas a little bit differently, and you'll actually start looking at other artists which you might have hated earlier.
Right.
And then realize, oh, if I hate it, actually it's because it was talking to me. But I couldn't deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Marcella Zitali is also with us, who assisted the artist for 17 years, Nikki de Saint Phalle. I keep saying assisted. Was it assistance or was it also collaboration?
I think a collaboration too, because Nikki used to work with a lot of people, but she always had one person collaborating with her in the studio, mm-hmm. And she has three persons all along her life. I was the third one until her death, so it was an amazing work. You know, it was wonderful to work with her all the time. Very tough because she was a workaholic. Working 12 hours a day, every day, and she never took any vacation or something like that. So it was quite an incredible experience.
How do you explain that part of your grandmother and your mother's personality that she was obsessed with? I think her first husband, your father, I guess,
mm-hmm.
Harry Matthews, described her as being, she would get to a piece of art or an idea, and she would become obsessed with it. Until she had done it. Well, how do you explain that part of her personality?
Well, there's a couple of things, but I think it's her American upbringing, you know. I mean, with both my parents, the work ethic was really, really powerful. So that's one piece.
Your father was a writer.
My father's a writer, mm-hmm. So they were very disciplined, and they really worked hard.
And know? Not initially. Your father wanted to be what?
A musician.
A musician, and your mother wanted to be an actress.
Yes.
And they went to Paris and found their way around into different careers.
Yes. Well, it was, you know, I don't know how to, it's so, can you say something?
Well, they were very young. They were leaving the country where they grew up,
mm-hmm.
and arrived into post-war Europe, which was pretty ravaged. And so things were very raw. It's also decolonization time. So it's really a time where everything is unstable. And when things are unstable, there's also lots of interesting things going on. Nikki was just obsessive compulsive. I mean, all she did all the time was work. She would be on the phone, her hand was drawing, and once in a while that drawing, she would go to Marcelo and say, okay, we need to do that now. And it was just always, and when you had lunch, that could be the most, okay, maybe when it was like Francis Crick, she would try and pick his brain, but usually it was always, always, always about her art, whether it was transportation, or exhibition, or next project. She needed that to live. It was her life.
Well, it sounds to me like it kept her alive and vibrant and thinking, but it must have been exhausting for the people.
Absolutely.
It was.
It was, very much so.
As always with type A personality.
You have to be like that in order to be on a sculpture. The sculpture is very complicated. Mm-hmm. It's not like a painted. You have just your canvas and your paint. The sculpture, you have to move things, very, very heavy things, and work all the time in the very complicated things.
Plus, it's not like a 9-to-5 job. There are always things you can improve on, and one little adjustment here that I can make, you stopping is difficult, it would seem to me.
Yeah, very difficult. And sometimes you finish your sculpture, it doesn't go through the door. You know what
literally.
I mean? So you have to demolish the house or change your sculpture, you know?
Or demolish your neighbor's wall to get the sculpture out, because there's a wider exit to get the sculpture out, which literally happened.
I was going
to
say this obviously happened. And what does that say? When somebody gets so carried away with the work that they have no concept of how big this thing is, and it's not going to be able to leave the room it was created in unless we destroy the room around it. What does that say?
Well, it says the art is more important than anything because you break the house to get it out.
She was the only woman who became a part of the avant-garde Nouveau Realists movement. Who were the other artists in that movement, John?
Well, Yves Klein is one of the most noteworthy, who died young. He was a great painter and provocateur and actually a brilliant writer. And there were others. I think that relationship was... But.
There's Armand, Martial Reis, Christo was part of it initially. I mean,
and John Tanguy.
John Tanguy, of course, obviously.
And he was her second husband and artist, and who I understand kind of pushed her out of the nest. He said, I'm not going to support you. You're going to support yourself with your art. So she was suddenly confronted with having to create to live.
That's right.
What kind of a taskmaster is this?
Well, they were a perfect couple because, you know, they did push each other throughout their life. And Jean's, as she said, medieval eye enabled her to do public works and architectural. She was really one of the first to go really, really monumental in sculpture and change the relationship between architecture and sculpture and make it one.
Jean Tinguely and Nicky de Saint-Phal were personal friends of Andrea Speckler, who's the benefactor of the museum.
That's, in fact, Jean was particularly close to Andrea.
Right, and many of his pieces are in the museum, and more of them will be displayed as part of this exhibition, Nicky de Saint-Phal, Creation of a New Mythology. When we come back, I want to talk about these sculptures that are sitting outside on the green, how big they are and what they mean and how you can touch them. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and McCall Center for Visual Arts Spring Fling, a gala featuring 8 individually decorated artist studios and art for sale by 26 local artists. Friday, April 1st, details at McCallCenter.org. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, it's the weekly news roundup. Hour number one, of course, the national news. Congress agrees to fund the government for another 3 weeks. The Environmental Protection Agency proposing new emission standards for U.S. power plants, and Fed Chair Bernanke says the recent surge in oil prices will not damage the American economy. Those and other stories to be discussed in the 10 o'clock hour. And if you'd like to join our conversation, now would be the time, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We are coming right back.
Family and friends are the anchors in our lives. As part of the Light Factory's Bring the Family exhibit, WFAE wants to experience your family's story through photography. Get your camera and your loved ones ready for our Bring the Family contest. Information is available at wfae.org/family.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Beckler Museum's newest exhibition, which opens today and runs through October the 3rd, inside and outside the Beckler Museum of Art, Nikki de Saint-Phalle, Creation of a New Mythology. And I want to talk about that and some of the bigger pieces that are outside. With us, Laura Duke and Bloom Cardenas. Laura is Nikki de Saint-Phalle's daughter. Bloom is her granddaughter. Dave Stevenson is with us. He's a trustee of the Nikki Charitable Art Foundation, which handles her personal art collection. John Boyer is president and CEO of the Beckler Museum. And Marcello Zitali, who assisted the artist, collaborated with the artist for 17 years. Off the air, I was just saying that we were talking to Dave Stevenson about the fact that he's kind of the business manager, was her business manager for years. And I said, well, every good artist needs a business manager, because artists don't think like business people. And immediately Bloom said, oh, no. my grandmother and grandfather thought about business. So did you find that to be the case?
Yes, she understood. She understood that she needed to have money to be able to continue to make the art. And that's, you know, so that's why we sold art. She kept most of her art, and that's why our collection is so huge. But she would sell on occasion in order to have money. The only reason she wanted money was to be able to make more art.
You have to buy the raw materials.
Yes.
Now, and you have to eat.
And you have to build.
Right.
Also, so when it's big, it costs.
She built the Tarot Garden in Italy all out of her own pocket, out of money that she raised. That was the land was contributed by a private party, but she built the entire Tarot Garden at a cost of, I'm sure, several million dollars out of her own pocket, and she was in the process of doing that in the United States with the Queen Califia's Magical Garden in Escondido, California, mm-hmm. when she died, and we finished that project for her.
She had a special love of sculpture gardens, which came about, as I understand it, from an initial trip to Spain, where she saw one and spent much of the rest of her life thinking about and doing these things, getting pieces ready for these places. What was it about outdoor art that so captivated her?
Well, you're talking about Barcelona and the Parc Güell from Gaudi, who is an architect who did art.
Uh-huh.
So in a way, he's really one of her big masters, and that he influenced her tremendously. I remember 25 years ago reading an interview of Nikki dated 1961, saying how her dream was to create a sculpture park created based on the tarot cards. And at that point, I had already slept in it. So just to give you an idea of the will this person had, at 31, she knew she was going to do it. And in her 50s, she was living in it. I mean, really quite a powerful mind.
How big was this place that she had a kitchen in the left breast and a living room in the right breast? How big was this sculpture?
The sculpture, the Sphinx, it's big. It's 22 sculptures all together. Some are inside others. So that tells you how big they are. And you can visit the Tarot Garden. It's 2 hours away from Rome.
And they're made
Rome.
Out of what?
Well, steel, concrete, and then they're all covered with ceramics that were made there, site-specific. It's haute couture ceramics and mirrors, and that's when she started actually playing with mirrors, and the Firebird is definitely a child of the Tarot Garden.
The garden, it's over several acres, to be sure, and as you say, 22 pieces. But when you think about the Sphinx, and there's a small version of this Sphinx sculpture in the exhibition, but you have to imagine that small version exploded to the size of a house. I mean, so you're talking about a sculpture that is the scale of a domestic dwelling in the U.S. with multiple bedrooms and living room and all the rest, all of it completely covered with stone and mirror and colored glass. I mean, these things are breathtaking. And this notion of creating a magical experience that is transportive, and it's a different kind of world suddenly as you're walking through these acres among and within these remarkable works. And so in many ways, that's why we're so grateful to be able to have the five pieces that we do, in addition to the Firebird, outside for everybody to enjoy.
And this has been described in the public relations pieces, as being set in fantastic surroundings, dreamscapes populated by strange creatures, animals out of place with each other, sometimes threatening, sometimes benevolent and peaceful.
Perfect.
Right. Put your headphones on for just a second. And I apologize to you that you don't have a set of headphones. Marcella will translate for you. I'm going to take a couple of calls, and then I want to talk about the pieces that are involved in all of this. Robin in Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I just have a comment. I have a 7-year-old nephew, and last week his teacher assigned him, or the class, an assignment to write a short page on a current event. And the minute he saw the, I believe it's pronounced La Cabeza, on the front page of the Charlotte Observer, he insisted that that had to be his current event. So we went online and got a little bit more information, and he turned in his paper yesterday, and he's very excited about going and seeing the exposition this weekend.
Now, La Cabeza, is that the 14-foot tall sculpture inspired by the Mexican death mask, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Day of the Dead.
And why did this capture his attention? How old is he again? 7?
He's 7.
Okay.
It was a combination of the colors and just the overall size. He's just fascinated at the fact that it's probably about 6 or 7 times taller than he is.
Now, both Laura and Bloom have these big smiles on their faces as you're talking about.
Yeah, well, Nikki would be really, really proud and happy.
He's looking forward to crawling inside.
Great. Well, thanks for the call.
There's nothing that made her more happy than have children playing with her sculptures. And you mentioned the tactile aspect. And, you know, that's the feminine creativity. You know, you can touch things. You can see them.
But seriously, don't you worry about damage? If you have a horde of children every day for the next 6 months coming out to touch and play and crawl and climb on these sculptures, you're not worried about them being damaged? Well, you were in on the creation of these. Are they childproof?
Absolutely, it's supposed to be for childs. You know, it's she was all the time. She always say that my primary public is kids.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. I work for kids.
Okay.
And inside the
it works too.
Inside the La Cabeza is a meditation chamber. So her intent was that you'd go in there and think about your life and reflect.
Before you become the skull.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, and so that you're not afraid of the skull also. Like, that way you can tame it and make it yours, and it doesn't have to be a scary thing.
Wow.
It's really beautiful when you go inside. It's amazing.
Well, I can't wait. Thank you for your call, Robin, and congratulate your 7-year-old for us. Tim in Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I just want to say what a wonderful show it is. But the comment about taking the art out of the house and sometimes you have to destroy the wall or whatever to get it out, it just reminded me of the whole childbirth process. And I wondered if she ever considered how this was like giving birth to her art.
Perfect. you got it. No, definitely. And, for example, the Sphinx is a sculpture that you enter through... Can I say vagina?
I don't know. You can.
All right. You enter between the legs. And this was something so that, you know, you come out again, you know, you go inside the womb and come out, hopefully, another person. It's an esoteric garden. But the first major sculpture, architectural size that she made, which made her quite public in collaboration with Jean Tingley and Peter Uloff, was a big woman lying down, and you entered again in between her legs, and there was a milk bar inside and all these things, and you would come out a new person.
She is also famous for her series of nanas, which are what? Enormous female figures in various poses.
Not necessarily enormous.
Okay.
But yes, it's the nana power. It's the... You know, it's actually, we were talking about it with John yesterday. It's like first, it's also the transition from all her anxiety, of the things she worked out through emotionally, psychologically, and then these women sort of overcoming and being forceful, beautiful, strong. Not necessarily the type of beauty of the day also.
Tim, thank you very much for your call. Do you want to add anything else before I let you go?
No, thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome. You talked about female beauty that she did want to depict in some of her art, and it should be pointed out that she was a beauty because she was on the cover and the interior probably of several magazines, including Vogue and Elle and Harper's Bazaar, in the early part of her career. How did that? Because for some people that's a great asset, some people it's a great burden. And I guess for an artist, she has an eye for things and for her own beauty. How did that affect her art, I guess is the question here. The fact that she was beautiful herself.
She used it as a tool.
Okay.
She totally used it. With the shooting paintings, the more successful she got, the sexier she became, and really used her beauty as a weapon because, especially in the 60s, I mean, it's very much a different context for men and women. And that was the power that women could have and use, and she abused it.
She abused it?
Yeah. She was so beautiful, you know, and she was very glam before it was hip to be glam. I mean, she and Warhol had a few things in common as far as using the image, and the New Realist were sort of all like that. Yves Klein put on suits. Mm-hmm. She also, when she did her tears, she had a sort of Barbarella look. I mean, they were very conscious of image and the power of that.
Wow.
Jean always had his blue working suit. It was a show, and they were aware of image.
Well, and you mentioned that they were both business people. They understood the need to make money so that they could make more art. And Sylvia writes on Facebook, since the early 80s when I got her perfume, Nikki had a perfume, in the blue bottle with colorful snakes, as recent as last semester, I've preached and admired Nikki for all she stands for and the things we will never understand. Charlotte will never be the same. Thank you, Beckner Museum, for enriching our lives. Wow. Talk about this perfume bottle, because she did create perfume bottles.
Well, she created this perfume to pay for the tarot garden. That was one of the ways she could be independent and total master of her own creation and not have anyone tell her what to do. So the perfume, she got a lot of bad press from it, for being an artist and making perfume and blah, blah, blah.
Being too commercial?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But if you look at it today, they're all doing it. She was just, you know, 30, 40 years in advance.
And that's the sign of an artist. She's ahead of her time.
Exactly.
Larry in Pineville writes, did Nikki in the 60s and 70s hang out at Max's, also known as Max's Kansas City, on Park Avenue South in Manhattan? You don't know.
I don't know, but it could be, because she did hang out in New York in the 60s.
Okay. Let's talk about these pieces being displayed outdoors. You don't have to pay. You can just go out there. You can sit in the sculpture garden. Now, these things, there are five of them. They weigh more than 13,000 pounds. And a lot of people may not be aware that the green, this park that's outside the Radcliffe condominium building across the street from your museum, is actually sitting on top of a parking garage, which is underground. You had to assess the structural stability of the parking garage, right, to make these things, make sure these things wouldn't damage the garage?
Yes, we did. You know, the Gabesa itself is 7,500 pounds.
Okay.
So that's a lot to carry. So we met with the structural engineers, represented by Childress Klein and Wells Fargo, to make sure that we understood where all the structural columns were that supported the fabulous green on top. And let me just say, by the way, this is not a public park. This is another one of the great gifts that Wells Fargo gives to Charlotte by making this available for people to use for all kinds of reasons. And they've been a great partner as the corporate sponsor for the exhibition itself, but also to allow us to have the five pieces of sculpture there. So once we got past all the security concerns, which are de minimis, and the structural concerns, which were significant, we were able to figure out where to place everything.
Wow.
And of course, having La Cabeza right across the street from the museum staring at us all the time is exhilarating and mesmerizing at the same time.
How do you transport and install these enormously heavy pieces?
Well, in that case, we have this piece in three pieces. So each time somebody has to come over here and work in the setup with a crane and everything. Mm-hmm. And usually this piece is traveling all the time. If it's not, we have a storage in San Diego to keep it.
I want to remind folks that you can see some of the pieces that we're talking about on our website, WFAE.org, and obviously at the Beckler website. As well, there are 55 pieces in this exhibition, and the trust, as you said, she kept many pieces in her work, most of her work. She didn't sell it.
No, not most.
Most, but a lot of pieces she kept for herself. Is that because she couldn't part with it, because it was too important to her personally? Or why did she keep it?
Well, she was extremely prolific. I mean, she was working nonstop.
Well, if you hold things back, the value of the art increases, right?
Well, she did keep her early works, because her first gallerist actually would refuse to sell them, and always, she was a little upset at the beginning, because obviously you're a young artist, people want to buy your art, you want to sell it. And he said, no, one day you'll thank me for it. Well, it's taking some time for people to really understand a lot of her early works. But she did major donations to Germany and France, mm-hmm. because she has a very big audience over there, and they know her work and they followed her work for a long time.
How many pieces in the Trust collection?
Ooh,
over 1,000 plus lots of graphics.
And where do they live?
They live in Santee. We have a big warehouse in Santee.
Wow, it must be enormous, because some of these pieces are big pieces. And where do these pieces that are on the green stay when they're not on exhibition? Where do they live in that same location? How did you choose, in 10 seconds or less, how did you choose these pieces?
We were looking for a variety of size, subject matter, but also a theme connecting back to the exhibition itself.
That's John Boyer with the museum, the Beckler Museum, Laura Duke, Lynn Cardenas, Dave Stevenson, and Marcellus Itali. Nikki de Saint-Fall through October 3rd at the Beckler.